He vehemently dismissed the entire thing as hackwork. It was a tactic his poorer students used. They mocked the subjects they'd failed to study. The commissioner quickly agreed.
I don't trust critics who like everything. If everything is good, nothing has any value. Without garbage, there is no gold. Is it not so?
Absolutely true, Senlin lied. But this piece, he turned again toward Ogier's painting. Girl with a paper boat. This is something remarkable. The character of your local light seems to have inspired a novel style. It's primitive, perhaps, but evocative and precise in its way.
I agree. I have impeccable taste, the commissioner said,
and signalled Senlin to continue with a slight roll of his wrist. I would love to write an essay on its novel palette. Here, for example. Senlin leaned nearer the thick pane that sealed Ogier's painting, and as the commissioner leaned in to follow his point, Senlin affected a series of abrupt, spasmodic sneezes. Horrified, the commissioner flew backward into Taru with his arms thrown over his face. Grey eyes bulging from his smooth doll's head, he shrieked for his guard. The barks of his dogs rang over the noise of the room. Gasps and stifled cries rippled through the waltzes. The band stumbled, faltered, and soared to a halt. Blue-breasted agents appeared from several directions. Very quickly, Senlin found that he was surrounded. One of the agents presented the commissioner with a pewter tray that carried a black rubber gas mask. Two gold foil filters protruded from the cheeks of the mask, like blunt tusks. With the deftness of a reflex, Commissioner Pound fitted the mask over his head and cinched it tightly against his face. Dark lenses, large as the lids of jam jars, hid his eyes. The commissioner had gone from obvious to impenetrable in the span of a few seconds. How could Senlin pander to a man who had no visible expression? There was no time to fret over it. Senlin hurried to explain.
I'm not ill, Commissioner, I assure you. I'm only sensitive to scent.
He produced a handkerchief and blew his nose delicately, almost noiselessly.
This may sound absurd, but I think someone has gotten perfume on your painting.
Senlin dabbed at his eyes, sneaking a glance at the commissioner as he performed. He saw nothing behind the blackened lenses. The mask distorted the commissioner's breathing, even as he threatened to hyperventilate. The room seemed to be listening and leaning in. The commissioner's breathing gradually returned to an even swell and whoosh. After a moment more, he uncurled and raised a single finger, signalling the ensemble to resume their play. The music broke the tension in the room. A laugh escaped. The woman atop the piano gave a tentative kick, and the party recommenced. Everyone, it seemed to Senlin, was quite accustomed to the commissioner's fits, and had learned to handle them efficiently. Still in his gas mask, the commissioner exited onto the large balcony, the agents sweeping Taru and Senlin along behind him. Since his fate wasn't clear, Senlin tried to appear as if this were all part of a tour. The young men and women canoodling along the parapet saw the agents and the masked commissioner and quickly drained back into the ballroom. When the commissioner finally removed his mask, Senlin found that the diminutive and allergic tyrant was scrutinizing him. He held the expression of a man squinting into a heavy wind.
It seems we share more in common than just our appreciation of the arts, the commissioner said at last.
Senlin fought to remain straight-faced, though a chill ran up from his stomach to the top of his scalp. Of course, he hadn't smelled even a trace of perfume on the painting, but he gambled that the commissioner would go along with the charade rather than risk his standing as the bath's most sensitive nose. Hoping the man's vanity extended even to his failings, he had made a contest of a flaw.
As ingenious as Ogier's work is, it is all tainted by perfume, the result of his studio's proximity to a lady's boutique. All his work is soaked to the atom in scent. I'd hoped the glass would contain it. A pity. I will have to return it to the vault.
Pound straightened his collar and waved the agents away with another roll of his wrist.
Commissioner Pound,
Senlin hurriedly interjected,
The work may be salvageable.
I'm sorry, Professor Senlin, but I don't take risks when it comes to my sinuses.
Then allow me. Let me suggest a simple deodorizing process, a technique I've had to learn. Senlin dabbed his handkerchief at the corner of one eye. If I fail to rid the paint of every trace of perfume, you will have lost nothing. If I succeed, your masterpiece can retain its prominent place on your wall. It seems a pity to shelve such a jewel unnecessarily. The commissioner returned the stiff silver lock on his forehead to its former glory, the rubber gasket of his terrible gas mask having upset its shape.
I am suspicious of good Samaritans, Mr. Senlin.
I have ulterior motives, of course. While the painting is being defumed, I'd like to study it, and with your endorsement, write an essay on it. Senlin tried to sound as if he were making a minor confession.
I don't feel comfortable releasing my property to strangers.
I would not ask you to, Commissioner. In fact, the process I have in mind requires only sunlight. Direct exposure to sun, I've learned, neutralizes almost any pollutant, though with paintings the exposure must be managed to avoid bleaching and craquelure. Craquelure was one of the more obscure painting terms he had gleaned from his studies. He used it now to establish his credentials, and it seemed to have the desired effect. The commissioner smiled. Perhaps you could rope off a little corner at one of your skyports, and I... The smile vanished, replaced by a scowl, straight as a mail slot.
The port? Out of the question! It's impossible to secure! Beside the professional sinners, the pirates and smugglers, there is a whole host of amateur cretins, imbeciles, drunks, henchmen, lapdogs, whores, spoon-snatchers!
The commissioner did not so much conclude his list as douse it with the tipping back of a champagne flute he snatched from a tray. This paranoid litany reminded Senlin of the charges he'd heard read before the boy was wrenched in two by the red hand. Despair welled within Senlin. His whole plan depended on this point. He had to separate the commissioner from Ogier's painting, had to get it out in the open and away from the agents and their cannons and vigilant dogs. Failing this, the rest of his plot was a useless ravel. Taru gave Senlin a discreet smirk, which he took to say, "See how the plot collapses, headmaster. Look at your three-legged, two-headed horse try to run."
"Commissioner, if I may..."
Taru swept his hat, which resembled a poisonous mushroom cap, from his head and genuflected.
"There are many ways to cook an egg. As I recall, you own a little portion of the sun, your solarium. Good for entertaining, yes, but also very secure. You once told me it was accessible only through the bureau building. Don't your men have barracks there? What could be more secure? The professor can take his notes and watch the sun do its work."
Taru seemed very pleased with the suggestion, though Senlin hardly shared his enthusiasm. He wasn't familiar with the bureau building, but he didn't like the sound of it.
"It's not an idiotic suggestion," the commissioner said, but Taru continued to charm him.
The professor could act as their canary in the gold mine. When he no longer felt the tickle of perfume, the painting would be declared fit for the commissioner's heir. The commissioner was soon persuaded. He invited Senlin to his solarium in the morning.
"I'll tell my men to expect you. I will desire a copy of your book once it's published," the commissioner said, in parting, sliding now toward other guests inside his mansion. "I trust I'll get a mention in the credits."
"I will dedicate it to your generosity," Senlin said, smiling as he bowed. Chapter 8. Often the simplest way to unlock a door is to knock upon it. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. Overnight, the champagne bubbles turned to sand, and Senlin woke to a heavy head.
He rolled from the rut in the hotel mattress and turned up the gaslight by his bedside. The light pinched his eyes, and he grimaced. His coat, trousers, shirt, socks, and boots lay in a trail across the floor. Foggily, he recalled celebrating with Taru after leaving the commissioner's gala. His friend had begun the revelry by kicking his ridiculous hat into the reservoir and hiking a Jeroboam of champagne onto his thick shoulder. Senlin had no idea where he'd gotten the huge bottle. Taru insisted that they go carousing. Before Senlin could protest, Taru tipped the Jeroboam toward him, dousing Senlin's face, compelling him to gulp defensively. Oh, he wished he could pretend he had been coerced, but when Taru said,
"Go to bed if you must, Tom. I'm a fly who lives for a day. I must buzz until I die."
Senlin had gone off buzzing willingly. He poured water into the chipped ceramic basin atop the hotel vanity and splashed his face. He shaved slowly in the mirror without looking himself in the eye. He couldn't fathom why the evening deserved celebrating. His plan, ill-conceived as it had been from the beginning, was spoiled. What was there to celebrate? His plan had been to get the painting out in the open, where there were more escape routes and fewer agents. A bustling skyport had seemed the most opportune place. It was as chaotic as the customs gate, but not as heavily patrolled. Shiploads of wealthy tourists arrived almost hourly at the port. Distractions would be plentiful. Senlin would wait until a tourist, some socialite with a birdcage stuffed full of banknotes, caught the agent's attention. Amid the furore, he would swap the original Girl with a Paper Boat for one of Ogier's inferior copies. The artist said he had many, and hopefully one would be serviceable. Senlin doubted the agents would notice the difference. They weren't art critics, after all, and he hoped it would be days or weeks before the commissioner studied the painting closely enough to realize that he had been robbed. By then, Senlin would be halfway home with Maria on his arm. Such a pretty delusion. Taru had been right to call his plan a three-legged, two-headed horse. Taru doubted Senlin was capable of the sleight of hand a swap required, doubted that Senlin would be able to remove the painting from its frame in the span of a few moments. And how did he propose to sneak the copy in, or the original, out? Did he intend to stuff it down his shirt front? It hardly mattered any more. He had failed to convince the commissioner to move the painting to the port. Now he would have to brave the headquarters of the Bureau, which Taru had described as a hive of offices, barracks, armories, and oubliettes. Perhaps his chances of stealing the painting had been better while it still hung in the commissioner's mansion. There was nothing to do now but carry on and hope for an opportunity. As soon as he had reassembled himself, Senlin went to the concierge of his hotel and requested a blank sheet of stationery. The concierge, who weeks ago had marked Senlin as a poor guest who tipped accordingly, offered him a thin, musty, slightly crumpled sheet. Too queasy to respond to the slight, Senlin took the paper and penned a note to the artist. "Dear O, I need a good copy of The Girl. Bring it to the cafe this evening. Yours, S." He hoped the artist would interpret it correctly. It seemed prudent to be discreet. He addressed the folded note to Ogier's perfumery apartment and gave it to the concierge to deliver. The concierge was surprised then to receive a shekel, a reasonable tip. This wasn't the time to be frugal. Senlin needed to know the note would be delivered. The concierge snapped a young porter over, then graced Senlin with a prim bow. Senlin might have been more gratified by the rare expression of respect if it hadn't reduced him to his last 6 shekels. He was almost broke. The next time he saw Taru, he would have to compound his debt of gratitude by asking for a loan. In the narrow back alleys of the baths, under the flags of drying hotel sheets, an aged peddler sat behind a ratty collection of books splayed across a threadbare rug. If Senlin hoped to impersonate an art critic, he'd need something to write upon. He asked for a journal, and was offered a book bound in rawhide. It was roughly cut, but sturdy. The first 10 pages were filled with some poor sot's attempt at romantic verse. Senlin scanned a few lines. "That leaking hippopotami sprays our paddle boat. Your flaxy hair swamps the prow as I row your petticoats." He cringed. After paying the seller 2 pence for the diary, he ripped the poems out. The Customs Bureau building clung to the chamber wall like an immense mollusk. Its rearmost cornerstones, each twice the height of a man, melded with the limestone superstructure of the tower. The bureau, set too far from the dazzling mirror balls, sat in permanent twilight. Tongues of condensation and swarthy lichen darkened its granite masonry. The building reminded him of a mossy castle keep. Arrow loops, crudely painted over with foggy glass, slitted the walls, while, high above, men patrolled the ramparts. Agents flowed in and out of the entrance, black shellacked batons gleaming at their hips. The raised portcullis inside the archway reminded him of a wolf's open mouth. He reset his satchel strap on his shoulder and allowed himself a deep and settling breath. He must do this for Maria. He must pretend to be brave. True to his word, the commissioner had made preparations for Senlin's visit. The agent stationed at a rosewood podium beneath the now familiar black banner recognized Senlin's name immediately and called over a cadet who had been pushing a broom about the lobby. The acneed youth, dressed in a pale blue version of the customs uniform, was told to escort Senlin to the solarium. The cadet clicked his heels and saluted with a curt chop of his arm. The young man's glassy-eyed obedience struck Senlin as tragic. He had seen how much esteem the Customs Bureau had for youth. He had watched, and watched again in his nightmares, a boy's head pulled from his body like a cork from a bottle. The interior of the bureau was whitewashed and lit with electric bulbs that burned bright as crucibles. Racks of rifles and sabers were around every corner. Iron doors rasped open and clanged shut. Boot heels rang against the flagstone floor like hailstones. Senlin couldn't tell if the distant human sounds he heard were those of men howling with laughter or wailing in pain. He was still waiting to feel brave. He felt as brittle and small as a piece of chalk. They passed a map room that was glassed in like a terrarium. Inside, models of the tower stood on pedestals. Like countries on a map, each ringdom was painted a different colour. It was incredible to consider how much of the tower still lay unexplored above him. A few officers stood about a tea cart parked outside the map room, their double-breasted jackets open and showing a red lining. They watched Senlin like cats, their postures relaxed, their eyes active. The cadet hustled on, unfazed. Senlin was glad to have the excuse to hurry past the officers. He was then led through a barracks that was large enough to be measured in acres. A team of laundry women stripped the bedclothes from the rows of bunks. It was obvious the commissioner had an army of men at his disposal. Senlin matched the cadet's brisk pace for a quarter hour before it occurred to him that the facade of the Customs Bureau had been much too shallow to accommodate such a long walk. But then, it only made sense. The entire building had been carved out of the tower wall like a rabbit warren in a hillside. Every step forward brought him nearer to sunlight. They came at last to a spiraling stair that ended at a large iron-bound door. The cadet stopped and swiveled on Senlin, his young ruddy face straining with the effort of making eye contact with his taller charge.
"I beg your pardon, but may I ask a question, sir?"
Senlin nodded, stiff with surprise.
"What is spring like?"
the cadet asked. He was obviously uncomfortable with addressing Senlin, and so he hurried on. "I've read that the ground breaks open, and all the flowers leap out at once. Does it make a sound? Does the earth shake? What does it smell like?" Senlin's concentrated frown lifted at the corners. He recognized it was a genuine question, so he rallied to respond with a sincere answer.
"Spring is grey and miserable and rainy for 3 or 4 weeks while the snow melts. The ditches turn into creeks, and everything you own is clammy as a frog belly. Then, one morning,
You walk outside, and the sun is out, and the clover has grown over the ditches, and the trees are pointed with leaves, like 10,000 green arrowheads, and the air smells like... And here he had to fumble for a phrase. Like a roomful of stately ladies and one wet dog. The cadet considered this with smirking wonder. Then his face blanked, and his back went ramrod straight again. "Thank you, sir," he said, clicked his heels once, and retreated. Senlin watched him go and marvelled at the idea. To have lived and never seen springtime. The boy may never have even set foot on the ground. Surely that would be the case with more and more people the farther up one climbed. He refocused himself on the door and turned the thick knob. Blinded and teary-eyed, Senlin stood blinking in the doorway of the solarium. He felt an unanticipated swelling sense of relief at seeing the sun again. He felt like a drowning man who had come again, at least briefly, to the surface. The solarium protruded from the tower's façade like a blister. A half-dome of framed glass peaked 20 feet overhead. Light streaked across a meticulously waxed parquet floor, which stood empty except for an easel and a chair. A lone agent, with a grandfatherly paunch and a grey drooping moustache, presented himself with a similarly droopy salute, his head dipping to meet his raised hand in a half-hearted effort. Despite his languidness, Senlin did not overlook the long flintlock pistol jutting from his belt.
"I am Christoph," he said. "You are the critic with mud on his boots."
Christoph regarded him with what seemed paternal suspicion, and Senlin felt like a boy caught rifling through his father's pockets.
"Please present your bag for inspection."
Christoph took Senlin's satchel, feeling along its seams, first squeezing and then probing its pockets. He glanced over Senlin's guidebook, wrapped lunch and empty notebook. While Christoph riffled through his pitiful belongings, Senlin's eyes adjusted enough to see past the dazzling light and into the landscape.
"Pull up your sleeves for me, sir,"
the agent asked, with a little impatient wave, as if this were obviously routine. Senlin showed Christoph the thin reeds of his forearms, the pale onion bulbs of his elbows. In the far distance, at the edge of the arid basin, mountains cut upon a cloudless sky. The same mountains their honeymoon train had climbed weeks earlier. The same mountains where they had made use of the privacy of their sleeper car, even as it yawed back with the train's ascent, and their ears popped, and their hearts flew against their ribs like caged birds. Though it was not this tender memory that held his attention now, because here, in the immediate foreground, the balloons of an airship rippled grandly in the wind. Not one balloon, but three, each separately larger than any single gas envelope he'd ever seen. Senlin had once been to a fair where a hobbyist with a hot air balloon gave tethered rides for a shekel. He'd been too shy of heights to buy a ticket, but had watched the gondola float up and slide down for hours. That balloon had seemed large as the moon at the time, though it had only had to lift a small jute basket and a couple of brave souls 200 feet into the air. The trio of balloons he gawped at now seemed like planets in comparison. Senlin took 2 steps to see past the horizon of the handrail that encircled the solarium, so that he could see what sort of magnificent vessel required 3 Jupiters to hold it aloft. The vessel dangled from a jungle of cords. It hardly looked like a sea-going ship, as airships often did. Rather, it looked like a colosseum that had been yanked from the earth. He counted 3 levels of hatches and saw at the base of it an open drawbridge. The ship was moored to the immense cantilever of the skyport. From one of the ship's rails, the same black and gold flag that hung in the commissioner's mansion twisted in the wind.
"She carries 78 guns.
Christoph surprised Senlin by speaking just over his shoulder, his breath stinking like a barman's rag. Senlin stiffened but did not turn.
32-pound demi-cannons that could put a dimple in a mountain. Her hull is 116 feet across, 183 around. I walked the watch on her for 18 years,
until, finally, he backed away and slapped his gut, which bounced against his hand like a drum.
I'd had my fill.
What's she called? Senlin asked.
Christoph's neck piled under his chin and spilled over his cornstarch collar. He seemed to be sizing Senlin up.
You really do have mud on your shoes. Thick mud. Everyone knows that ship. That is the Commissioner's flying fortress, the Ararat.
Senlin shrugged at his ignorance.
She looks fierce. Good, because it hangs like a millstone and pitches around like a bat. Once the guns start firing, it's a victory if you hold on to your breakfast.
Christoph belched and then waved Senlin toward the chair that faced the easel and the center of the room.
Look at the painting. Make your jots. Our talk has made me nostalgic.
Christoph began pacing the perimeter of the solarium with a laborious and shuffling step, his blue cap drawn low over his eyes. Sometimes, when he passed behind Senlin's line of sight, Senlin would hear the gurgle of a tipped bottle. Senlin pretended to study Ogier's painting. With the glass removed and the sun, the real sun, adding to the dazzling spectacle of the little painted scene, it seemed more wonderful than it had on the commissioner's wall. Even so, Senlin only pretended to observe it. He made little nonsensical notes and uttered thoughtful exclamations of discovery. Whenever he could, he glanced at Christoph in his slow orbit. He was trying to deduce the man's intelligence. Christoph seemed a little exhausted by life, a little drunk, but Senlin did not think he was as lackadaisical as he appeared. This was an easy assignment. It was the type of soft work that was given as a reward to a good soldier, a vigilant and perhaps wily one. Senlin invited Christoph to share his lunch. He hoped to stir a little more casual conversation between them. They sat, Christoph on the floor, Senlin in the only chair, eating the cold chicken kebab Senlin had brought. Once they finished, Christoph produced a second lunch from his coat pocket and ate it without offering Senlin any. He expressed no interest in any of the olive branches of small talk Senlin offered, responding only with long bovine looks. Christoph chewed, a little cow-mouthed, apparently untroubled by thought, his eyes red at the corners. Senlin wondered if he hadn't given Christoph too much credit. Perhaps he was a simple man who could recite a few technical details. He could be some captain's daft uncle, or the childhood friend of a far-removed duke, for all he knew. After another 2 hours, the sun fell dead, even within the little room, and began baking rather than lighting the air. Dabbing the back of his neck with a handkerchief, Senlin proclaimed his work done for the day, though he promised to return the following morning. He directed Christoph to remove the painting to a shadier room in the internal halls, instructions Christoph received with a poorly stifled yawn. Christoph again examined Senlin's satchel, saying in parting,
"I may ask you a question tomorrow, Mr. Mudd."
Senlin drew little attention as he passed unescorted through the halls of the Customs Bureau. He felt optimistic. His gait was almost jaunty. Perhaps his plan wasn't so awful after all. Perhaps it would work. He wondered what sort of question Christoph had in mind to ask, and whether it had anything to do with springtime. Chapter 9. The longer you linger in the halls of Babel, the more strongly you will feel the pull of allegiances, of clans, kings, and guilds. A man who stands alone is generally thought a lost tourist or a rogue. Many have found the one is a natural sibling of the other. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. His high spirits quickly steamed away when he returned to Café Riso. He'd expected to find Taru huddled about a bottle and amid a smattering of afternoon regulars. Instead, he found the patio deserted, save for one table where two buttoned-up customs agents sat. A pair of full wine glasses sat untouched before them. Senlin had seen many sotted agents in the past weeks, had seen them half peeled out of their blue coats, teetering and singing among the bathhouses, groping after the girls who sold cigarettes and oranges. Agents were far from moderate in their relaxations. These men did not look like they had come to unwind. They looked like a couple of owls, heads turning above rigid torsos, their eyes wide and scanning. Senlin veered away from the patio gate. He tried to appear as if he had been casually diverted, rather than chased off, but he sensed them, watching his about-face. He felt as if his whole plot was written out on his back. The hair on his arms stood on end. Ogier worked at his customary corner outside the café rail, but when Senlin began to approach him, the painter caught his eye, flared his own in warning, and then darted his lance toward the seated agents. Understanding his meaning, Senlin curved his path a second time, moving away and toward the shoreline of the reservoir. Prickling with paranoia, Senlin stalked along the water's edge. He wound his way around to Taru's usual spot by the water, but his favorite lounging chair was empty. Senlin asked the attendant who rented the chairs if he'd seen Taru today, and the young man shook his head. For a horrid moment, Senlin wondered if his friend was not avoiding him. Perhaps Taru had finally decided that the boorish headmaster brought more trouble than entertainment. Senlin could hardly remember a time when he'd felt more alone. To keep from lurking about and drawing attention to himself, he found a bench with its back to the water, where he could sit and keep an eye out for Taru or Ogier. A meandering peddler carrying a crate full of clanging bottles cried,
"4 pence for a grip of grappa! 4 pence for a grip of grappa!"
over and over, like a determined whippoorwill. The peddler stopped by Senlin's bench, repeating his call until Senlin could stand it no longer. He told the peddler he would buy a bottle if the man agreed to take his song elsewhere. Senlin counted out 4 small copper coins, and then briefly considered the remaining palmful of change. It was all that was left of the small fortune he'd spent years saving. Years! And for what? To hang himself and lose his wife? He wanted nothing more than to uncork the bottle and drain it. It wasn't self-control that kept him from doing it either. It was fear. He was afraid that when he climbed out of the bottle again, it would be as a hod. Where was Taru? Probably scared off by the agent squatting on his patio, or sleeping off the previous evening's celebrations. If Taru was off snoring somewhere, he'd picked a terrible time for it. Senlin needed his friend. He needed, of course, to ask him, plead with him, if necessary, for a loan. But he also needed a foil for his thoughts. He still had to figure out how to smuggle in Ogier's imitation and sneak out the original. A half hour later, Ogier appeared through the stand of bathhouses that divided the mall from the shore. He toted his easel, paint box, and a sling of canvases. The burden made his hump seem more distinct and inconvenient. Red-faced, Ogier sat down on the opposite end of the bench, without glancing at Senlin.
"What did you do?"
Ogier said, wheezing softly. He lit a cigarette from a match he struck with his thumbnail.
"Those agents were sitting there all day. Were they after you?"
"I hope not. Perhaps it's just a coincidence," Senlin said, though he doubted it. At least the painter was finally sharing in his dread. It only seemed fair. "Have you seen Taru?"
"No."
Ogier tapped his cigarette rapidly until the ember became an angry orange cone.
"I hope you aren't counting on him. I told you, he's unreliable."
He rehung his stained hair behind the platters of his ears.
"How are you making out?"
Senlin briefly explained his plan and the setback of the solarium, concluding with the hours spent under Kristoff's eye. "He went through my bag like a hound." Senlin thought of how Kristoff had checked his sleeves, and how he'd snuck up behind him like a cat, and of his familiarity with the armaments of the Ararat. "He could be a drunk, or he could be an admiral, for all I know." Ogier didn't seem overly pleased with any of it.
"How will you sneak the copy in?"
"Is it off the stretcher?" Senlin asked, and Ogier nodded.
"Perhaps if I folded it..." "It's a painting, not a newspaper,"
Ogier said, his voice cracking with alarm. He quickly regained his tone.
No, the creases will show. They'll spot the copy in a moment. Besides, I don't want the original returned in squares. You can roll it, but under no circumstances should you fold it. I'd rather not have it at all.
Well, it hardly matters, and I still have to figure some way to get Christoph out of the room. Senlin squeezed the long bat of the grappa bottle. The bland label that wrapped it appeared to have been drawn by hand, though not by a very talented one. The solution to both problems came to him abruptly.
"Do you have the copy with you?"
"Of course,"
Ogier said, and pulled a small rolled-up canvas from his sling of supplies.
"It's the best I have. I only had a few sketches and my memory to work from. I don't know how much scrutiny it will stand up to."
Pound knows what his collection is worth, but I don't think he really knows the pieces half as well as you think. Your copy may hang on the wall for years before anyone notices, if anyone ever does.
"You think this is a permanent solution?" Ogier asked.
Senlin shrugged. "Even if Pound does suspect the copy for what it is, what would he have to compare it to? Of course, if he does get suspicious, you'll be the first person he visits."
"That has occurred to me. It's a risk I'm willing to take," Ogier said.
"Good," Senlin said, with a tight smile. Inside, he was boiling again. Ogier was willing to risk everything, including his life, including Maria's life, for a single painting. To Ogier, Senlin was nothing but an errand boy. If Ogier decided to go back on his word and not divulge what he knew of Maria's circumstances, Senlin would have no recourse but violence. Perhaps Taru had been right. Perhaps he was running at the wrong end of the rabid dog. If Senlin and Taru surprised the painter at his rooftop apartment, they could make him confess. Unbidden, an image of a red-hot brand flashed to mind. He again saw the nurse, or rather the awful woman pretending to be a nurse, pressing the seething iron against Edith's smooth skin. The nauseating smell of burning flesh was so fresh in his mind it was almost palpable. Senlin suppressed the memory with a shudder. He was ashamed to have even considered such a thing. When he looked at the artist again, his anger toward the man had fled, and what he felt most of all was pity. Here was another man who had been made desperate by his love. He took a deep breath and said, "It must be done tomorrow. Would you lend me a couple of matches and a bit of wax?"
"I have a stub of a candle. Will that work?"
Ogier asked, and Senlin nodded. As the painter handed over matches and the stub, his expression clouded.
"This is where I first saw your wife, on this very bench."
The confession seemed to trouble him. Had his conscience finally been pricked? Had it dawned on him that he was essentially holding a woman hostage? "I am risking my life for your painting," Senlin said. "Before I go to face capture and execution, tell me, is Maria alive and safe?" Ogier scowled down at the cobblestones, looking every bit as wretched as Senlin felt.
"Yes," he said, finally. "Meet me here at 5 tomorrow. Have my painting. Not a crease now."
The next morning, Senlin presented himself again to the registrar of the Customs Bureau. No escort was offered him, and he was left to retrace his path from memory, which had been sharpened by fear. The halls felt a little more pinched, and the agent's expressions a little less glancing today. He felt like the cheating student tormented by the scrap of paper tucked in his sock. Only his stubborn poise kept him from breaking into a trot. He was relieved when he found the solarium and almost glad to see Christoph leaning on the rail and eating a croissant. He held the long bars of his moustache up with one hand as he shoveled his breakfast in with the other. Senlin presented his bag for inspection, and Christoph nosed through it sleepily, still chewing, his jaw sawing slowly like a cow. When Christoph saw the full bottle of grappa rolling at the bottom of the satchel, he pulled it out and examined the hand-drawn label.
"Grappa! Very good."
He patted the bottle affectionately, and placed it back in Senlin's bag.
"Take off your boots and pull up your pant cuffs," Christoph said wearily, as if this were the same routine of their previous encounter.
Senlin did as he was directed, hopping awkwardly on one foot as he stripped his boots. Christoph peered into the boot barrels, and then waved Senlin to his seat before the easel. The morning proceeded much as it had the day before. The sun prickled his neck. Christoph circled the room, listless as a vulture. The girl in the painting hesitated near the shore. At noon, Senlin unpacked a lunch of potato dumplings and cured dates. Christoph seated himself cross-legged on the floor, presuming that Senlin would again be willing to share, which he was. Christoph was delighted to see the tall grappa bottle liberated from Senlin's satchel. Christoph drank from the bottle as if he were dousing a fire. Senlin took a much shorter draw, while Christoph sucked on his brandy-dewed moustache. They ate in silence. Senlin repeatedly took a small drink from the bottle before passing it to Christoph, who always drank more deeply. Christoph finished Senlin's lunch and again produced his own, which he devoured with mechanical swiftness. Senlin sipped the unrefined brandy and gazed at the world outside. Distance transformed the market below into one of Ogier's paintings, a scene of daubs and colours devoid of hard edge. It felt as if he had climbed onto another earth. Christoph climbed unsteadily to his feet, his ears red as tomatoes under the unruly grey fringe of hair. His moustache hung crookedly to accommodate a smirk. He gave Senlin a stuttering heel-stamp salute, marched unsteadily to the door, and leaned his back against it. Slowly, he slid to the floor, lowering his cap as he went. He laced his pudgy fingers over the shelf of his gut, and soon began to snore. Fearing that the agent was staging a ruse, Senlin crept across the lustrous parquet floor, wobbling on tiptoe. If Christoph woke, he decided, he would ask to be shown the restroom. The barrel of the guard's pistol had been turned upward by the man's collapse, and the oiled iron barrel seemed to wink at his approach. After a few skittish advances and retreats, Senlin reached down and swatted the tip of the man's spit-polished boot. Christoph gave no sign of waking. Satisfied that the rot-gut had done its work, Senlin returned to the painting. Popping Ogier's canvas free of the gilded frame took little effort, but removing the canvas from its rigid wood stretcher, where it was held by dozens of staples, proved to be a challenge. He undid his belt, pulled it from his pant loops, and used the prong of the buckle to pry loose the wire horseshoes around the edge of the painting. He kept one eye on the snoring Christoph as he labored. He'd smuggled Ogier's copy in by rolling it around the long grappa bottle, the back of the canvas facing out. For all intents and purposes, it looked like an oversized label. He had affixed the canvas to the bottle with a nearly imperceptible seal of wax, and then redrawn the crude label in pencil. The result was reasonably convincing. It looked like the swill anyone might buy on the street. Now Senlin unfurled the copy and fitted it to the newly empty stretcher. Replacing the staples proved more difficult than he'd expected. His fingers quickly began to throb from pressing staples back into place. If one became stuck, Senlin was forced to go through the nerve-wracking process of tapping the staple with the butt of the wine bottle. The chore took a quarter hour to finish, and erasing the label took another few minutes. But in the end, the painting appeared straight, flush, and centered when viewed from the front. The back of the painting was another matter entirely. If it were ever removed from its frame, his hackwork would be immediately apparent. There was nothing to do about it now. He could only hope the painting would hang with its back to the wall for decades to come. He scrolled the original around the dark bottle with the painting facing in. He softened the nub of wax he'd brought with Ogier's match and rubbed it on the seam to seal the new, blank wrapper in place. He didn't have time to redraw the label's heraldry, and he doubted that Ogier would forgive him for defacing even the reverse of his masterpiece. Senlin could only pack the bottle back in his satchel and hope that Christoph didn't peer too closely when he conducted his exit inspection. With any luck, the man would be too drunk to uncross his eyes. The swap complete, Sandlin sat again with the easel before him, his notebook casually open on his lap, the sunlight lapping warmly at his nape and the tips of his ears. Having stared so long at the original, Sandlin immediately recognized the copy for what it was, an inferior vision. The copy was by no means artless, and had he never seen the original, it might have even seemed a work of modest accomplishment. But he had seen the original. In the imitation, the girl's proportions seemed a little inelegant and dwarfish. The water, though heavily highlighted, appeared flat. The once magnificent, tantalizing shadow beneath her seemed now an inconsequential gloom. The composition, palette, and style were all similar to the original, but Senlin could understand almost how Ogier had become obsessed with the one and indifferent to the other. It was a half hour more before Christoph snorted himself awake. He roughly cleared his throat and rubbed his mouth. His eyes winked and slowly returned to a concerted blinking. Rising in the same leaning fashion that he had descended, he straightened his cap and pulled on the hem of his coat. He resumed his circuit around the room, as if he had never paused. When he came up behind Senlin, seated before the forgery, the agent stopped. Senlin felt the man's presence swell behind him. Perhaps it had dawned on Christoph that Senlin had been too generous with the brandy, suspiciously generous, in fact. Christoph might, even at that moment, be moving his hand to the grip of his flintlock, was even now sighting the back of Senlin's head, ready to earn the commendation that awaited him. Senlin squeezed his eyes shut. And he stayed like that until Christoph's voice forced him to steal a glance over his shoulder. He found Christoph leaning on the rail, staring indolently down at the market, his head rolling dreamily from side to side.
"I would have liked to have been a merchant. The travel, the exotic sunburnt women, the fresh beef, the rain, and the puddles," Christoph said, breaking his long silence. "I've never tasted a fish that wasn't salted or drowned in oil."
"You were born in the tower," Senlin said, relieved that Christoph seemed oblivious of the forgery.
"Of course, in the house of Pell, long may it stand."
The agent pointed up with his thumb and then flicked the tip of his nose with it.
"My mother had hoped I would climb a little higher over the course of my career, become a chancellor or a duke or a lord of port. But it turned out that I wasn't very good at bowing and scraping, and that was two-thirds of high society, though I liked the other third," he said, with a wink and a drinking gesture. "And now, Mr. Mudboots, I'm ready to ask my question."
A little charmed by Christoph's confiding tone, Senlin replied,
"All right. I was a lookout on the Ararat. I kept her from running into trouble, wind shear, and pirates. I have the eyes for it, and a head for understanding the signs. Bird swoops and cloud breaks, and the little funnels that devil the sands. Personally, I don't care one way or another if you want to steal the Commissioner's painting, Mr. Mudboots. But I am curious. Are you toadying for the House of Alges, or are you a lone wolf?"
Senlin nearly leapt up, but managed to only stiffen his back a little. He kept all trace of surprise from his voice.
"I don't know what you mean."
Christoph turned to face Senlin, who still craned awkwardly around in his chair. His moustache seemed now a theatrical frown.
"Look, I'm tired of making life easy for Commandant Snot. He has made life so tedious for me."
Senlin recognized the seditious bitterness in Christoph's expression, and it gave him a glimmer of hope.
"Every post I draw is twice as dull as the last. If I turned you in, I don't doubt Pound would reward me by shifting my patrol to the fountain toilets."
Christoph sounded almost sober now, though he still soared a little on his feet.
"I know you aren't an ostrich, because your arms aren't branded. If you came up from the dirt, you must be fairly clever. Probably quick with a bribe or handy with a sidearm.
The fact that Christoph's estimation flew so far above Senlin's accomplishment came as a surprise. But this surprise was quickly trumped when Christoph drew his pistol, though without much haste.
"Your boots were stitched in Alges. I saw the A stamped on your insole, which may mean nothing. Alges boots are sold here and there, I hear. It may be a coincidence. Or it may mean that your credentials were forged and you're a spy of the House of Alges."
The accusation baffled Senlin. He had never read or heard a word about Alges. The angle of Christoph's gun made it difficult to think. He doubted that a denial would convince the agent, and he was too flustered to think of a convincing lie, so he blurted,
"I am the headmaster of the only school in a fishing village called Esau. I came here on my honeymoon with my wife, but I have lost her. The original artist, who is withholding information about my lost wife, coerced me into stealing this painting for him. I'm only doing this for my wife."
Using the barrel of his pistol, Christoph knocked his cap back on his head and scratched his brow with the bead of the gun.
"You're a good liar."
The same attentiveness and suspicion that made Christoph a successful lookout also, apparently, blinded him to honesty, which was probably just as well. Senlin could think of nothing to say except,
"Thank you."
"I wish you were half as good at painting. This is a terrible forgery. The commissioner will spot it, or one of his beetle-brain curators will. How much money do you have?"
"I have 2.5 shekels to my name."
"A very poor pirate. Imagine that. For 2.5 shek, I can give you an hour's head start."
Christoph holstered his pistol and asked,
"Do I smell of drink?"
"Strongly," Senlin said, straightening his arm as he dug into the pockets of his trousers and coat.
He placed the last of his coins in Christoph's palm.
"Then I will give you 2 hours.
Christoph shooed Senlin from his chair with an exasperated sweep of his arm and sat down with a grunt.
"If you ever decide that you do work for the House of Alges, tell them that I'll entertain offers. I'd make an excellent rat."
Senlin refused to run at the door, though his heart beat at him to do just that. Instead, he walked with determined and loping steps, like a king at his coronation. He would not run. He would not. Christoph called after him when he'd reached the door, and Senlin turned to find him pointing at the painting with a smile that was yellow as old ivory.
"Why does the dwarf walk on the water?"
he said, a hiccup turning into a belch. Chapter 10 The baths are like a chrysalis. Exhausted men and women wrap the baths around them, and in a fortnight are transformed. One may come in a worm and go out a butterfly. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. The Customs Bureau building was crowded now with the changing of the shifts. A cacophony of boots, exaggerated by the odd acoustics of the corridors, drummed everywhere, like an unbalanced engine. The air was thick with a musk of leather and sweat. No doubt the atmosphere would have been toxic to, what had Christoph called him, Commandant Snot. Senlin couldn't help but imagine that the agents leered at him more knowingly now. He came around a blind corner and collided with a man who stood a head shorter than him. It was a minor bump, but Senlin felt like a train had struck him. The man, dressed in white, craned his neck back and peered at Senlin from under the frayed brim of a straw hat. His unwrinkled, poreless complexion reminded Senlin of a boiled egg, and his large round teeth seemed to have been worn down by habitual gnawing, as if he made a point of worrying the bones left on his dinner plate. The red hand's pale blue eyes were distant, almost sleepy.
"Isn't he tall? Yes, quite the specimen. Prominent brow, thin lips,
the red hand said in a low, meditative grumble.
Sharp chin and cheeks. Such a tragic visage. Must be from the land of cod and ballads and lighthouses, like something straight out of a textbook. Eastern Ur-male.
The Red Hand's deduction was startling in its accuracy. Even amid his shock, Senlin couldn't help but be impressed by the man's intelligence. But before Senlin could formulate a coherent reply, the Red Hand swept past him, his hands balled in his pockets, the soles of his leather sandals clucking against his heels. Senlin gulped at the lump in his throat and hurried on. He could only hope that Kristoff was as good as his word. Though, really, what were 2 hours worth? He'd planned on it being weeks before the forgery was discovered, had planned to borrow a little money from Taru and collect Maria and be halfway down the tower before the commissioner could loose his hounds. He'd planned to vanish into the human maze, Maria clutched to his side, not just clutched, but also tied, like the old spinster sisters had been lashed together in the market. But so much had gone wrong. A chorus of bells rang 3 o'clock as he exited again onto the gloomy street. His satchel seemed to pull at his neck like a millstone, the bottle biting into his hip like a riding crop. Many blocks stood between him and the bench by the glittering reservoir where he was to meet Ogier. He had no choice but to run. If the painter turned out to be a liar or a villain, if it turned out that he was behind Maria's present difficulties, and all of this had been a ruse to trick Senlin into doing his dirty work, Senlin wasn't sure what he would do. He might strangle Ogier in the streets, right in front of everyone. He wondered if a single soul would try to stop him, or if the tourists and drudges would part and pretend to look away. The thought horrified him. For the moment, he was still anonymous. No one paid his hurry much attention. He dashed like a rabbit between the curbs of the street, bounding over the gutters full of sudsy grey water and dodging the crones and wenches toting laundry baskets. He apologised until it became a string of indiscriminate pardons. By the time his feet struck the clean flagstones of the mole that ringed the reservoir, he was shining with sweat. The promenade was overflowing with vendors. The gaps between booths, which were buried under produce, tonics and soaps, were clogged with wagons at almost every end. He could hardly squeeze through. He veered toward the shoreline, where the crowd appeared for the moment more fluid, and regretted the decision as soon as he saw what had parted the crowd. Customs agents encircled a man, freshly shaved and stripped to the waist. A basket of coals sat at his feet. Senlin had stumbled upon the making of a hod. When he saw who was reading the declaration of the man's crimes, he stopped dead. It was Commissioner Pound, dressed just as he had for the ball, in a black suit that seemed to have shrunk a few sizes. He wore his nightmarish gas mask. The lenses over his eyes were as black as the bottom of a well. They seemed to stare straight at Senlin, and the illusion made his skin crawl. It was unfair. As hard and as far as he had searched, he could not find Maria, and yet he could not stop running headlong into his enemies. Senlin tried to dissolve back into the crowd, but found himself hemmed in between a wagon that was filled with fragrant melons and a perimeter of children in striped bathing suits, all gawking at the poor, ruined man. His crime was apparently entirely one of debt. The commissioner read a list of the man's unpaid bills to restaurants, clothiers, dance halls, theatres, hotels, and every other trap of pleasure the baths had to offer. Senlin didn't doubt that the charges were exaggerated, like those recited at the boy's execution. Regardless, this wasn't his tragedy, and he hadn't time to share in the man's misery. He'd be joining him soon enough if he didn't hurry. Senlin dug his forearm into the crowd, trying to open a gap. His efforts were rewarded by one of the children slamming her heel down on his toe. He let out a pained yelp, and the commissioner's litany halted. The cans of the gas mask whipped about and pointed at him. Pound called,
"Mr. Senlin! Mr. Senlin! I'm so glad I caught you!"
The words froze his blood, and the children recoiled from him. He felt as if he'd been shoved onto a stage.
I've heard that you have been very active in your notes. Good. I like a thorough scholar. A man who makes up his own mind can be trusted. Is it done, Fugue?